Today's episode is brought to you by our distribution partner, Virgil Films and Entertainment. Now, I've worked with Virgil personally, and I can tell you this is a company that champions independent filmmakers. With over 25 years of experience in film distribution and having partnered with brands like National Geographic, OWN, and Major League Baseball, their films, including the mega hot Super Size Me, the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, and the hit documentary Forks Over Knives, have landed on Netflix, Hulu, YouTube, Tubi, Apple TV, and more. They work directly with filmmakers and streaming platforms, and they offer a range of deals to fit different needs. They don't just distribute films, they elevate them. And truthfully, they're just really great people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com. And now, on to the show. Welcome to Documentary First, everybody. My name is Christian Taylor, and I am the host of Documentary First, also a documentary filmmaker. This podcast is an inside look at documentary filmmaking, and I am really excited today to have another documentary filmmaker with me here, Nicholas Bruckman. We call him Nick. This is the third time he's been on our show. Nick, we're super happy to have you here today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Christian. Glad to be back.
Yeah, he's talking about a new project. We're also going to talk about another project that he spoke about before called Mented, which is now you can find on Netflix. We're going to talk about how it got there. We're going to talk about a new project that he just came out with. It's going to be on the film festival circuit. It is called The Price of Milk. I just finished watching it. And boy, let me tell you, I got some really strong feelings about that. I can't wait to talk about. But first, let me read his bio. Nick Bruckman is an Emmy-nominated director and founder of People's Television, a New York City and DC-based creative studio producing award-winning films and storytelling campaigns for the world's leading brands, foundations, and social movements. His feature documentary, Not Going Quietly, which is phenomenal and everybody should see that, about healthcare activist Addie Barkin, won both the audience and jury awards at South by Southwest and was released to critical acclaim in theaters nationwide and on Hulu. Is it still there?
No, it's not on Hulu, but it is still on Amazon and Apple TV.
Good. His follow-up, Minted, The Rise and Fall, of the NFT, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, and I absolutely love that film, and was released by Netflix earlier this year, and I'm assuming it is still there.
It is still on Netflix.
Yep. Yeah. Most recently, the docuseries The Price of Milk, which we're going to talk about today, which uncovers the hidden story behind the iconic Got Milk campaign, had its world premiere at Tribeca in June. So that's just a small introduction of who Nick is. But Nick, thank you so much for all of those projects and for your experience. I really want to look under the hood and figure out about how you were able to make all this happen, particularly about, how the heck you get into Tribeca and how in the world you get your stuff on Netflix and how you get things funded, like The Price of Milk, because I just finished watching it. It was an excellent production. You used all sorts of things from amazing graphics to a lot of, archival stuff. You had interviews all over the place. So I know there was a lot of travel and just, talking heads and just different people that you interviewed. So it looked like it was a big undertaking. So a lot of questions for you.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate all the run through and there's different themes that emerge. And I know a lot of your audience is filmmakers themselves who are trying to make their first or maybe second or third or fourth project, and things are changing very fast in the documentary landscape. And so I'm happy both to talk about the stories, but also the behind the scenes.
I'm super happy that you're here because you're one of the filmmakers that I feel like I can talk to is sort of on my level. You're not, you're ahead of me, but you are an everyman in a sense where you are an independent filmmaker. You're trying to get your stuff out there, but you have been super successful with getting your things in the high profile film festivals. And now, getting your shows on, streaming services like Netflix. So let's start with how you're getting your things into Tribeca. That's really hard to do. How have you made that happen?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I should caveat by starting to say that film festivals are important, but they're not everything.
True.
Of course, they're really important launch pads for films. And I know that a lot of filmmakers can put a lot of emphasis on them. And I think that's right. I include myself in those filmmakers that emphasize them. So I don't want to diminish in any way, but I do want to make sure that we button this talk about Tribeca and how to get in with the fact that you can still make a great film and you can still get it out to the world without those laurels. But it is really important to think about how you're going to present your film to the world for the first time. That's where all the buzz and attention will begin. And so, you know, at bare minimum, like one piece of advice that most filmmakers, you know, will learn on their first film is to really try to reserve that first screening for the right fit. And that can be a really challenging process because everybody, you send your film to Sundance and it doesn't get in, as not all, some of my projects have, but many have not. And then you say, okay, well, what now? Do I try to go to South by Southwest? Do I go to Tribeca? What if one of them says no? What's the next best thing? So there's a couple things that I've done. One is just to, and this is, you know, important, is to really try to develop the pedigree of your project through different labs and markets. So we're talking about The Price of Milk, which is our four-part documentary series about the absurd history of milk in America. And we actually had that project developed at the Tribeca Creators Market in 2024. Uh-huh. Which is something that we submitted to. And through that, we're able to make some connections to the Tribeca programming team. I also have had projects in Tribeca in the past. But there are markets like that which help to cultivate some type of relationship with a festival. That way you're not just writing to submissions@sundance.org, but instead hopefully writing to a programmer there that you have some connection to. Now, that can help because you can put it on their radar early. You can get more attention from them. And a lot of filmmakers will say, well, how do I get those relationships in the first place? And there really are ways to do it. You can attend. The programmers often speak at events, speak at panels. They do these labs and markets. But I've done these different kinds of labs and markets with most of my projects, from Not Going Quietly to The Price of Milk. Not Going Quietly was in a program called Gotham Week, which is in here in New York, which is also a project development marketplace. There's also one that we participated in called Fast Track, which is run by Film Independent in Los Angeles. They have a documentary lab as well, and a producing workshop and a rough cut workshop. And the reason why these things are, I encourage people to apply to these things, it can be a bit burdensome to do that, is not only to make those connections to programmers, but also to evaluate the strength of the material in the first place. Even those, of course, like film festivals, are very competitive to get in. But it's a place where you can really show the work to a lot of peers and also to industry and get feedback. And I think that brings me to the last thing I just want to mention, besides kind of making relationships, applying to labs, is it really comes down to, I don't think it's that political. My first ever film that I produced, we made it with a crew of three. I was 25 years old. We submitted it cold. I didn't have any programmer relationship at the time, to the Sundance Film Festival. And I got the call on Thanksgiving weekend. Congratulations. And I wasn't, you know, everything I'd heard before that was, oh, you have to, you know, be the studio head. Harvey Weinstein can make the call, or, you know, that at the time. Now, I don't know. You got to be head of Netflix. We'll pick up the phone for you, or CAA or whatever. And so we didn't need that. Of course, those things do help. But fundamentally, it comes down to making something that is unique, that's competitive in the marketplace, that has a distinct point of view. And the way that I approach it as a storyteller, this is not about business or connections, is really back to this idea of getting feedback and getting feedback from peers, from people you trust. And every project that I've done has probably had, you know, going on 5, 10, 15 rough cut screenings. Mm-hmm. Where I've sent the links to friends. We've had screenings at the office. We have this technique where everybody gets a little form, a Google form, and they all have to, the movie ends, the rough cut ends, and everybody has to silently take out their laptops or go on one of the computers and put in their raw, unvarnished, unfiltered thoughts before anybody says anything. That way you hear what people thought individually. And of course, you can do this online, but I recommend making an actual form. Don't just say, hey, can you look at this and tell me what you think? try to actually put radio buttons in there that say, on a 1 to 5, would you recommend this to a friend? And where were you bored? One thing that I really notice when I'm in these rough cut screenings is not just what people click there, but when I see people reach for their phones in their pocket, if it's a live screening. And when you watch people do that, you got to cut that scene or shorten it. And so I say all this because I think fundamentally, this is the best way to improve as a filmmaker. You can also go to film school, have great, great collaborators, all of the stuff that, you know, is obviously fundamental to storytelling. But being open to critical feedback and continuing to iterate on your project until that stuff starts to improve. If you were getting 3s and 4s in the reviews of your film from your friends and family, keep working on it until you start to get 5s.
Yeah.
Because if it's not, if your friends and family don't think it's incredible, now you have to compete with the other 10,000 people submitting to Tribeca. So this is not foolproof. It's just to say that, you know, focus on being open, being vulnerable, and, you know, being, listen to the what people tell you about your work, because it can be really hard to get that perspective from the outside.
So true. What was that first film that you submitted?
It's called Valley of Saints.
Valley of Saints.
And I was the producer on the film, and it was at Sundance in 2012.
Where can we watch that?
That's also on VOD now, so you can download to rent or buy it on Amazon or Apple. It was a very formative project for me. It was directed by an amazing filmmaker named Musa Saeed, who I still collaborate with today. And we filmed it in Kashmir on the Indian-Pakistani border. Mm. And it's a narrative film, a love story, but shot in a very documentary style. And I was the producer and the sound recordist because we only had a crew of 3 to make the movie.
Well, and that was a scary time to be there, actually. My son was in Afghanistan at the time, right on the in the Paktia province, right near the Pakistan border.
Wow.
I know that was not an easy time to be over there.
It was not. And we actually included, the story is around some of the conflict that is happening there. And we actually included kind of some of the real protests and real strikes and things that were going, even though it was a scripted film, mm-hmm. we sort of incorporated some of those elements into the story, which I think made it really unique. And not a lot of films have been made in that part of the world with that perspective.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's why you got into Sundance. So congrats on that.
Yeah.
So let me just ask you about these creators markets and these labs. Just talk to me about exactly what that is. So, I mean, I've seen that when I've gone to Sundance's website or when I've gone to the Tribeca's website, and I really have been intimidated because they seem very onerous to get in. I feel like, gosh, I'll never get in. They're expensive or they're time consuming. And just explain a little bit more about what your experience is, you know, to get in and what it's like when you get in there.
Yeah. I mean, similarly to the festivals, they are very competitive. And we all just have to acknowledge that being a filmmaker, being a storyteller is a very privileged position. And there's always going to be, as well as any kind of artist, there's going to be more creators than there are room for in the market, especially when you're making, you know, kind of socially oriented documentaries. People want to kick back and watch reality TV. And mm-hmm. if you, you know, definitely want to work, you can, you know, you can definitely get into other parts of the industry that are not as competitive, but all of us in this field are really motivated. We're really passionate about the stories. We know that nobody else is going to tell them if we don't. And so we don't let, you know, a little rejection slow us down. And I've experienced plenty of it. For every project you just described, there's others that I couldn't get off the ground at all. There's films that I was gotten pretty far and never got out. There's films of friends that I've helped support that never got into any film festivals. And, you know, had to be self-distributed. And all of those things have found their way. So having thick skin for all that is important. But I do think applying for the labs can help because it can show you the promise of the project early on. And there's different kinds. There's some that really look at projects very early on at a sort of development stage. And there's some that you're sending the rough cut of your film to. And for documentaries, really, it's all about getting the story right in post. All of my projects have taken all three of the main kind of documentary projects you mentioned were in post-production for almost a year. And all of that was finding the story, refining it, making sure it works, having it resonate, doing those rough cut screenings. So the labs that do that are great. There's a rough cut retreat that I haven't participated in, held by an organization called Catapult Films. Although I've heard great things about it, but I would really encourage, a lot of film festivals have pitch sessions where you can pitch your idea or show your preview of it. But I can speak particularly to Gotham, which is kind of New York's main film nonprofit, and Film Independent, which is LA's main film nonprofit, as being very welcoming of new and diverse voices. Both of those programs are great. So they consist of kind of two different tracks. One is the kind of story workshops or labs where you really hone your craft. There's a directing lab at Film Independent, a producing lab, an editing lab, et cetera. Those are great. And then there's also, with both of these organizations, kind of networking markets. And those are really not about being a better filmmaker. Those are about connecting your project to industry. And that's really critically important. One tip I will say is that those, as we talk more about the business side of how do you find money, how do you find the programmers, how do you find the festivals, et cetera, at a lot of those labs, they do publish the names of the people who attended. Mm-hmm. And the people who attended are generally the people who are looking for projects in some capacity. And you can email those people and try to get to those people, even if you're not in the lab. So I recommend staying up to speed on who's attending these things. You can also just go as an attendee if you don't get in to many of these things, like Gotham Week here in New York, and buy a day pass or a conference pass and really try to network. And if you're a ambitious independent filmmaker, I know you'll have no problem kind of going up to somebody, shaking their hand, pitching your project, just getting their email and being persistent. And I, as any good producer, have a big spreadsheet of anybody who I think might possibly support a project, from a traditional investor to a donor to a foundation to a brand to a journalist, and trying to manage those relationships at scale. You know, you can be honest about being a first-time filmmaker or being, you know, up and coming and really trying to get your first project off the ground, and people are receptive to that kind of honesty and helping you out. Developing and managing relationships is important, and that's what those market side of those programs do. And there's a few more that are escaping me right now besides those two. And a lot of individual and local film festivals also have workshops and markets.
Well, that's what Google and ChatGPT are for. Exactly. I think you've given us a good list, and yeah, I really
appreciate I'm trying not to say AI in any of my answers today, just as a as like a drinking game to see if I can get through the whole interview without saying
it. Beautiful. I'm sorry I did it for you.
No, you're good.
But actually, thank you so much for those inside tips. I think that is the stuff that filmmakers are looking for. So thank you. Let's move on now to talk about Minted, because Minted is, we were talking about this last time. We talked about what was going on. You couldn't talk to us about it. I had a sneaky suspicion. You were talking to Netflix, and I was hoping that that would go through for you. It clearly did. I want to know how it happened, because my film was not accepted by Netflix. And so how'd you make it happen?
Yeah, well, don't, like I said about any kind of rejection, just to make you feel better, my other films, including Not Going Quietly, which got many, many industry accolades and attention, also was not acquired by Netflix. And, every project has its own path and journey. And I am hopeful that some of the tips that I'm giving here will, help you with your next film getting on there. And just like I said, with film festivals, like getting on the Netflix isn't everything. It was a really big milestone for me. I'm obviously excited to talk to you about it. And it was great to have a lot of the accessibility of it for a lot of my friends, and most of our friends, have it. And therefore it makes it easier to see. Nobody wants the friction of paying $2.99 to rent a movie, although they should, because it helps support these kinds of projects get out into the world. And in the case of Minted, the rise and fall of the NFT, We were lucky enough in April of this year to have the film licensed by Netflix in about 100 countries, not everywhere. And it was a deal that was done by our agents. So the project has a sales rep, and this is another part of the whole process that documentaries can have somebody that helps you navigate the marketplace. And this, they're not, you know, difficult to get a good sales rep necessarily, because it's their job to sell films. And it kind of, again, goes back to the first principles of having a great story. Getting into a film festival will help you get a sales rep. And in our case, the project was represented by Range Media Partners, headed by Jessica Lacey, who I don't know if she wants to share this, but is Susan Lacey's daughter, who you mentioned. And I really love that Jessica is both a industry executive selling documentaries, but also comes from a family of legendary documentary filmmakers. So she really knows and loves and cares about the craft, as you know, not just a Hollywood studio type. And they made the deal happen. And I'll mention that the deal was done in conjunction with PBS. The film broadcast on PBS Independent Lens, and they were able to do a joint deal where after the PBS broadcast, the film then went onto the Netflix platform.
Wow.
Which was great that they were willing to work together. I'll mention a couple other things that are important. From the perspective of the story, the reason I think that film was acquired was because not just about all the quality stuff that we've been talking about great stories, but it's also kind of the definitive film about this one cultural flashpoint. And Netflix, they send these mandates about what they're interested in.
Where do they send those? I've never seen those.
I'll send you one. They send them like once every few months to the sales agents, and they're very informal. They're like buzzy true crime. We're looking for the greatest big scams and cults. You know, they're not necessarily looking for some of the more mission-driven docs, which is why the industry has been having such a hard time. And I'm sure your other guests have talked about that. In the case of Minted, they really want projects that kind of drive like water cooler conversation, right? What kinds of films are people going to be like going into the office and saying, hey, did you see that new Netflix doc? You know, that's what Tiger King is, or the big celebrity thing is, right? You just have to subscribe to Netflix because, and the reason for their business logic, in my opinion, I'm not a, you know, streaming exec either, but their logic is they want people talking about the movies so that anybody not subscribing in that what friend group needs to subscribe or they're missing out. And so I think having kind of like the definitive NFT doc helped, because everybody's like, what was that whole thing?
Right.
And I don't know that it was strictly. So I think it's important when selecting your projects to think about, you know, you don't want to cater to the marketplace. You have to do what you care about and what story is you're passionate about. But I do think having something that has a little bit of that buzz and it's recent and it's like a cultural phenomenon, all of those, I think, are the reasons that Netflix took it. Even though, like I said, they did not take my previous film before that, which was, you know, in some ways a more elevated, more accoladed, won many more awards, but it was about a really difficult subject about somebody with ALS. It was very political. And unfortunately, there hasn't been as much acquisition of political docs. And so, you know, I don't know that I want to tell people, like, do what the marketplace says. Like, you should make the best story you can.
Let's just talk about that for 1 second. And then I want to come back to, we're going to have to clarify what Minted is about in case people did not listen to our other podcast, which you should. It is on YouTube and it is on your other podcast streaming platforms. But we do need to talk about what Minted is about. But let's do talk about this concept of making docs that, you know, the market wants, because we are in a situation where we can, I have always said on this podcast, you must think about the end result. As a filmmaker, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to go and make whatever I want to make and spend my money on all these things. And then try to go and sell it. And I just think that's folly these days.
I agree.
Because that's not the way our industry works anymore. It's narrowed so much and it's changed so much that if you're not thinking about what the buyers are buying,
you're right,
then you are throwing away your time and your money.
You're right. It's a balance of making sure that you are doing the project for the right reasons and your passion about the topic and the story are driving you forward, while also being realistic that there is an audience for this. Yeah. It's a story that needs to be told, right, by you, the storyteller, but it's also a story that needs to be heard. And right. there's an audience that wants to hear it. And I agree, you know, going back to ChatGPT, I mean, I do think that the first thing when you find, you know, oh, I met this amazing person and he's got this great story and he overcame this thing and it's going to be an amazing film. And I, you know, I would encourage people to go into ChatGPT.
Uh-oh, you broke your own rule.
I know. And ask it to list out every film about this topic. And there always will be.
Yep.
Including for NFTs, including about Milk, including even about Adi. There was other things going on. He's the subject of Not Going Quietly. And I wouldn't say to let any of that deter you, but watch those movies and think about, you know, how did they perform? What works about them? What didn't? And what is your unique perspective on this project? And of course, you know, the Fyre Festival had two documentaries made about it at the same time. It doesn't mean you can't do something. It just means you have to have a unique take, a perspective, and it has to have an audience as a subject. So you're right about that. And, you know, I just don't want that to mean that everybody's just chasing the same buzzy feeling projects, because if everybody followed that, there would only be true crime documentaries, which is 90% of what's out there.
So true. So true crime and horror, some sort of horror thing, because that's what sells, sadly.
Yes. Horror is fictional crime or real crime. That's what people want to watch. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And this is beyond the scope of this conversation, but I think having more media literacy, more cinema studies in school, more documentary introduction earlier on, that I think can really help cultivate more of an audience for it. I think it starts when people are young, but I'll just mention this one anecdote. Maybe I told you this before, but I was at the Copenhagen Documentary Film Festival, CPH Docs, with Minted last year. And all the screenings were packed and much more full than any festival I'd been to in the US. I mean, just regular Danish people just walking in, wanting to see every documentary. And I was asking somebody at a reception, like, why are the Danish people so into documentaries? And he said, oh, that's easy. It's because we're happy. We have great health care. We have good child care. And we have, you know, good employment here. And so when we have free time, we want to know what's going on with the rest of the world. And so we like to watch documentaries to learn more about that. And, you know, I think that's an interesting just take, because here a lot of people, for whatever reason, whatever your political beliefs are on why that's the case, people, you have to ask yourself, why are people so gravitated towards watching this kind of, like, you know, I don't want to say empty, because true crime is a great medium, but why is it that people want to watch that and don't have the energy on a Friday night to watch something really hard hitting about veterans or about healthcare or about, you know, the food industry. And so it's like a societal thing that I don't have any answers for, but it's just something that we need to think about, because that's where all the pressure for the Netflixes of the world to buy documentaries is going to come from. People have to demand them.
Why do you think it is the case in the US? What's your theory?
I mean, it comes down to, you know, like I said, outside of the scope of this conversation, because I think it comes into the political questions of if you take that anecdote I used about the, you know, Danish guy at its word, that people here feel a greater sense of struggle in their own lives. And so that makes them less inclined to watch cinema that has people struggling. And absolutely. Yeah.
And I think
it's as simple as that.
That's why sports is growing. So if you look at the sports industry, especially sports and streaming, it's where the money always is. Like you could true crime or the sports industry or the betting industry, you know, the kind of gaming industry. Those are.
Yeah. The betting thing is blowing up, you know, and there's also a social media component to this, right? Which is attention spans are going down. And I think great stories can be told on social. We make at our production company, People's TV, we make a lot of social forward content. I'm not a purist about only make documentaries for
you
the
big. Make mini docs, the 2 minute things for Asia. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, we make a lot of the vertical stories. No. I know about those. The soap dramas.
Yeah, the soap dramas. Yeah. I've heard they're not so good, but they make a lot of money.
Yeah. So it's like I said, it's a bigger topic than we can deal with here. But to leave it on a hopeful note, I think you know, the best thing people can do, filmmakers and audiences, is just engage more with great stories. Pay that, if it's not on Netflix, pay that $3.99 to rent The Girl Who Wore Freedom or Not Going Quietly or any other project that's harder to see on the bigger streamers and show that there's a demand.
Yeah. Well, I will say that when I talk to people who do watch documentaries or take the time to, they always say, I love them. I love watching docs. If they just make the choice to do that, they learn something new. And then people are like, I love learning new things if they just need to make that step. All right. So let's talk about Minted real quick. Talk about what an NFT is. Talk about why it was the
In the zeitgeist, a cultural moment.
What did you say it was? The film was like the
definitive.
There you go. That's the word I'm looking for. The definitive one.
Yeah. So Minted, the Rise and Fall of the NFT, was my previous film before The Price of Milk that we chatted about on a past episode. So for more details, your audience can go back to that one. But the film tells the story of the sudden and explosive rise of the non-fungible token, which is when a cryptocurrency like a Bitcoin is attached typically to a piece of art or something else that gives it value. And in 2021, when we started filming that project, a single NFT by an artist known as Beeple was sold for $69 million. And it shook up the entire art world. It made him the third highest selling living artist. And it created this phenomenon where artists around the world and collectors started cashing in on this meteoric rise of the value of these ephemeral digital tokens. And for people who are, you know, now familiar with Bitcoin, they'll know how these cycles can come up and rise and crash. And the story follows over the course of the 2 years, artists around the world whose fortunes rise and then dramatically fall through that market phenomenon. And it's now on Netflix.
Yeah. And it's definitely worth a watch. So make sure you do that. Now let's move on to this new film that I watched. Oh, well, it's actually a 4-part series called The Price of Milk. And I have to say, extremely well done, visually a beautiful film about a very dirty subject, if you want my opinion. I was not at all expecting where it went. I don't know why. I think I shouldn't have known you. I should have known it was going to go in that direction. But anyway, talk to me. My first question was, how the heck did you get excited about this subject matter? What made you want to tell this story? And give us the log line about it first.
Yes. So The Price of Milk is a 4-part investigative documentary series that follows the money behind the iconic 1990s Got Milk campaign and reveals the dark relationship between America, the government, and the milk and dairy industry. And it's a fun and wild ride, but also exposes, I hope you felt that way, but also exposes bigger issues with how industries can capture our government and our politics and our economy in ways that may not be at the best interests of everyday people. And that could apply to almost anything. And all my projects, I think, explore that to some degree. Yeah. But this one looks at it through a very kind of simple and unusually deceptive thing, which is a simple glass of white milk.
Yeah. And I will say, I did not read the log line before I jumped in. And, you know, you mentioned before Susan Lacey, Jessica Lacey, and her mom, Susan Lacey. I thought I was interviewing her today. I will be interviewing her tomorrow. And so I had to quickly watch your film, and I just jumped in without reading any prep, which actually I kind of liked. I liked just not knowing what it was about and discovering it as I walked in. And one of the things that I will say is I was incredibly impressed by the organization of the story. So I felt the story was super clear and told really well because it was divided into these four parts that were easily digestible. What'd you say?
I said no pun intended.
Yes, no pun intended. And it was, it highlighted, you know, it slowly took me, I felt like I was a frog in water actually. Because it slowly developed until I fully understood at the end how bad the problem was. Mm-hmm. So you gave me this education very slowly throughout the series. And then, you know, I fully understood at the end, holy cow, this is ginormous. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the right expression that you keep using for the project. Holy cow. Yeah. And
pun intended.
Yes. Well, thank you. I'm really glad it resonated with you. And it was my first time doing a series. And I'll mention that it began as a feature, like most of my other projects that we've talked about. And going back to those rough cut screenings, when we were trying to put it together as a feature, it just wasn't really working as a story. It was too sprawling. It was too complex. It didn't have the kind of traditional arc that you'd want in the three-act structure of a movie. And so we decided to break it up and turn it into an episodic series. That is what you saw.
Yeah, well, that makes sense completely. What I did love is I thought it was brilliant that you did have this, you start with this one couple, and Joe and Brenda Cochran, and they are small family farmers. And it was very easy to follow their story and kind of their experience all the way through the movie. So you kind of see yourself as them going through this process. That was easy for me to get my head around. And I really appreciated that. And then you see their kind of plight, because really that's what this whole thing is about. You see, it's the small farmer versus the corporate farmer. That's kind of the beginning. And I didn't really even begin to think about, how that happened in the United States, that I knew because I had actually done a voicing for this project where we were talking about how we were losing these small farms to big real estate people that were buying up the farms because the younger generations couldn't make a living farming and they were turning them into developments. And so we were just losing large swaths of America. So I knew we were losing these small farms. I didn't understand it was also happening to these corporations. So that was a highlight for me.
Yeah, that's great that you had some connection to it. And I think when a lot of people read the log line or even hear the title, The Price of Milk, they might think that the story is about milk being bad or bad for you, or that dairy farmers are bad. And it's really quite the opposite. As you pointed out, the heroes of the story are small dairy farmers. Yeah. And the price that we talked about is kind of the price that we all pay for the collusion between big dairy, industrial dairy, and the government, which is what the series explores. So episode one is about the Got Milk campaign, which is actually a USDA, that's the United States Department of Agriculture, checkoff program.
So right, it's a you introduced program. This term called checkoff, which I thought it was the playwright checkoff. I was like, did they take that name and make it mean somewhere else? Yeah, but it's check, C-H-E-K-O-F-F, check off. And that was a hard concept to understand. Why don't you explain that real quick?
I'll do my best. And it's a very obscure word. It's a program for the USDA. It means to check off a box for a farmer to take their pen and check a box. And the reason that people will know about checkoff programs is because they've heard of all of the advertising. At least if you grew up in America in the 90s, as I did, you will have heard of Got Milk, as well as beef, It's What's for Dinner, perhaps pork, the other white meat.
Yes.
Maybe the touch, the feel of cotton, the fabric of our lives, the incredible edible egg. These are all generic advertising programs, which I don't think people have thought too much about, kind of think of them as regular, I don't know, PSAs, like eat your vegetables, but actually they're a U.S. government program that all of the producers of that product are forced to pay into. And what we explore is whether that mandatory tax on America's farmers to advertise these kind of generic products, A, whether the advertising works at all, and B, whether it's worth it for the small farmers. And this is, as you pointed out, Christian, all set against the backdrop of small and family farms closing across America. And what we discovered through our research and following the reporters in the series is that these programs are actually basically robbing America's small farmers blind and transferring that money to big industrial farms. And they're sort of doing it with the pretense of helping America's farmers, but really they're helping these kinds of, executive dairy industry moguls who we uncovered in the series.
Well, and this is going to shock you because it shocked me, but I have another touch point to this story because you say these advertisements were in the 90s, and they were, but they started actually in the 80s.
That's true.
When Reagan was elected, and you had Milk Does a Body Good in the early 80s, right? But somewhere in there, correct me if I'm wrong, they realized that there was this huge surplus of cheese and butter and all of these things. And they tried to get rid of that surplus by giving it away to, the poorer populations in the U.S., barely made a dent. And they had to find some other way to subsidize these farms so that they wouldn't go under, sort of like holding up the banks.
Exactly.
And so the USDA, under the Reagan administration, decided to create this check-off program. And so they decided that they were going to tax the farmers 12 cents on every dollar or whatever. They were going to tax them and then use that money to pay advertisers to create these campaigns to encourage us to buy more milk or buy more cotton or clothes or buy more whatever in order to help these farmers so that they would, the small town farmers, so that right. They would not go under. That was the premise.
You got it. Yeah.
You did a great job explaining.
Yeah, you did it better than me. A little bit, there's, some of this began under Carter. So it's, difficult to pinpoint, exactly where the checkoffs went wrong. But I will say that it's actually a program, like many things in our government, that had some good intentions. The idea of increasing demand to support farmers is not necessarily a bad idea. But what we explore in the series is how it kind of goes off the rails and how the project is taken advantage of by the lobbyists who have their arms wrapped around our government.
And this is where I want to explain my connection. Yeah. My father was the deputy undersecretary of agriculture.
No way.
From 1980 to 1984.
Wow.
Under Ronald Reagan.
Is he still with us, may I ask?
He is still with us.
I'd love to get his take on the show.
I tried to call him today. Yeah. I haven't been able to talk to him yet. I remember him saying to me and talking to me at the time, because I worked in Washington on Capitol Hill in radio and television production. That's how I got my start, actually, cool, in this industry. But I remember him talking to me about these huge surpluses of dairy and how they needed to subsidize the farmers. And I remembered them trying to figure out a way. I even actually found some papers as I was going. I had to move my father into an assisted living. I was going through all these papers. I found paperwork. I should show you this. I have found paperwork on this stuff that he was working on this.
Amazing.
And so my father's a good man. You know, he was the undersecretary under Jack Block, who was from Illinois.
Wow.
I knew these people. So I knew that they had good intentions to help these farmers. Jack Block was a farmer. So
it's,
like
it's
you said,
world.
Yeah, there were good people trying to do good things with good intentions. But then my father became a lobbyist after he left. And this is this rotating door, right? So my father became a lobbyist who had a good relationship with Trent Lott, who at the time was the majority leader in the Senate.
Yeah. Right.
His job was to lobby the senator about, you know, these how to vote on certain bills. My father then was reliant on clients to pay him to pressure the senator to vote certain ways.
Sure.
And so he now is reliant, his salary is reliant on clients.
Yep.
To pressure the senator to do certain things.
Yep. That sounds about
and
right.
And there you have this untoward relationship, right? It's not really, it's not really pure anymore.
Yeah, that's right. There's a total revolving door between private industry and government. I mean, it's an interesting personal take on it. I really want him to see the series and see whether he thinks we got it right, because we do try to cover that time period. And it's important to say that, you know, we look at milk as this kind of like, it's almost comical, like to think about making our, you know, 2 hours of television about a glass of milk, but you could apply a lot of these issues with money and politics to almost any other, first of all, any other food, but also to any other industry, to the weapons industry, to the defense, to, you know, many other ways in which our representatives are not always acting in our interest, but because everybody's got a relationship with the milk and everybody remembers the Got Milk campaign, we thought this was a fun entry point and not a too, you know, talking about movies that people want to engage with, a way to explore these issues without hitting you so much on the head. And I want to mention that one of the things that excited me about the project is the Got Milk campaign itself is actually like incredible advertising. Some of the ads are totally iconic. The first Got Milk campaign was actually directed by Michael Bay of Transformers fame.
Really?
Yeah, the one about Aaron Burr and the contest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you'll have to see the series or look up that ad on YouTube. So there's a lot of, you know, it's a way that you can kind of use pop culture, all the celebrities who did the mustache, as a way to look at these bigger problems in our food industry and in our political industry, and hopefully to get people to think a little more critically about where their message is and where their advertising and where their food comes from.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that Got Milk campaign was incredibly popular, but what you showed us in this film was that it didn't benefit the farmers at all. That's right. What we didn't get to. So the farmers paid for this, and then the small farmers didn't benefit from it at all. They paid for it, and yet they're still not helped, and they're continuing to lose their farm. And what's interesting is then you contrast that with a corporate farmer masquerading as a small town farmer who actually I pass constantly as I drive to Indiana.
To see
my kids is another touch point, to see my kids at Wabash College. I drive by Fair Oaks Farm.
Wow.
I've actually eaten there. And I actually thought, wow, this is such a cool place. And guess what? I buy Fairlife milk. I stopped for a while when I heard about the abuse of animals, but then, you know, I heard about how they had reformed and changed things. So I started buying Fairlife milk again. But after this, I will never buy Fairlife milk again, because now we have learned that they're not small town farmers. They're masquerading, and they're actually penalizing the small town farmers by what they're doing.
Yeah. Episode 2 explores an example of a dairy baron, Mike McCloskey, who runs Fair Oaks Farms. And we explore the animal abuse scandal that happened at his farm that you mentioned in 2019. And, you know, it's important to kind of back up and mention here that the series is not telling people not to drink milk. We're not telling people you should switch to switch to oat milk or plant
milk. But we should talk about that.
Well, and that's why, we do it, because what we're going to get to in this conversation is how this series came to be and where some of our money came from to finance it. So I'll go ahead and go there now, which is...
Before we go there now, let me just say, if it's not to tell people don't drink milk. What is the purpose of it?
Yes, great. I spoke a little bit about this before, which is that one, it's really to look at how policy is shaped and how laws and how our collective rules around food are written. If you go all the way back, I reference Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which was an investigative book written in 1910, I believe, about the meat industry. And the book was such a powerful expose that it led to the creation of the Food and Drug Administration, because we realized that we needed collective rules to regulate industries that otherwise are just incentivized to maximize profit at everyone's expense. And so when I think about great reporting on food and this series in particular, sure, it's good to change your consumption habits. And I applaud not buying Fairlife. And if you watch The Price of Milk episode 2, you'll see exactly why not to buy it. But it's not a problem that I think as a storyteller and advocate around this issue that it can be solved at the supermarket.
Right.
It's a political problem, and we need to make sure that our leaders, our representatives, are advocating for our best interests and are creating rules around these industries that protect us. And the only way we can do that is if we're informed about what these industries are doing in the first place. And one of the big problems with the checkoff program is that it's totally opaque. There's no transparency about how the money is spent. You see the journalists trying to submit requests that are blocked out by the government. And it's the U.S. government trying to keep journalists from getting information about how its own programs are run. And so, starting with transparency, education, political engagement, those are what the series is about. And of course, supporting your local farmer is great and can be part of that. But it's also about how we, work together as a society.
Yeah. And ultimately, how we vote. Because being engaged politically is more important now than ever. And we must be engaged in our cities, in our states, and nationally, we just must. That's our responsibility and our duties. People died so that we have the right to vote. That's my little pitch. So please be please be engaged. Now let's go to how you funded this film.
Yeah, so this is the most important thing. And actually, usually I start with this in our Q&A, and it's included in the series as a title card. But I was fascinated with milk for all the reasons that we talked about and, grew up with those Got Milk commercials. But it wasn't until I heard that a plant milk company was looking to partner with a filmmaker and a production company to tell a story of some kind that I got interested and actually developed the story. And I got with my producing team in touch with Jeff Goodby, who came up with the Got Milk campaign, and talked to him about this project and learned about all of this stuff. And then I went to the plant milk company. They're called Oatly, and they're disclosed in the credits. And again, we show this in the film, in the series. And pitched them on this idea of what if we explored the story from this perspective? What if we looked at the Got Milk campaign? And everything we just said about not telling people not to drink milk, not telling people to drink plant milk, that was kind of rule number one for the collaboration, because what we talked about is if this series in any way feels like it's promoting plant milk or telling people what to drink, it'll be advertising. And what Oatly wanted to do was actually fund an independent documentary. And they were amazing partners because they allowed my co-director, Yoni Brook, and our producers, Jen Malak and James Doolittle, who are absolutely critical to this whole project, even though I'm here talking to you, they deserve all of the limelight.
Absolutely.
They gave us the freedom to tell the story that we wanted. And that was very unusual and really exciting. And what I think it speaks to is that now there's opportunities like this where brands are realizing that they can support great storytelling and they can fill a gap in the marketplace, because I don't think any traditional funder or documentary investor would have supported a project this ambitious.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah, so and it's an important caveat because we want to make sure that audiences everywhere know that we had this connection, because again, all of this, everything I just told you is about transparency. And so when you edit this together, you might want to consider moving this part earlier into the edit. It's up to you, at least, you know, knowing that
we can put that in the show notes. We don't edit. We just put it up there as it is. So,
no, but I wanted to say that in a lot of our presentations around the film, we have the Oatly logo on there. The disclosure is important. And it's kind of ambitious, and it's a new way of partnering with brands to get documentaries made and seen. So I'm very excited. We had a great premiere at Tribeca. We brought the farmers to come. It was their first time in New York City, and they came down to the red carpet. And they had a great time, and they got to share their message with an audience. It was a little subversive, and it really showed our independence. I don't think anybody would imagine that a plant milk company would support a documentary about dairy farmers.
Yeah.
And bringing the dairy farmers to share their message with the world. We really wanted to make something that was universal and inclusive and, was the story that Yoni and I wanted to tell.
Yeah. I mean, hats off to Oatly for sure. I'm so thankful that they funded you. I think that's such a creative way to find funding. I'm glad you've brought this kind of to light. How can other people look for, similar opportunities?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I run a production company called People's TV. We've talked a little bit about the work that we do, and that includes doing some storytelling with brands. I think that as somebody in a career in independent film, making work that's commissioned or brought by brands is a great avenue towards making a sustainable living. There's different ways of doing it. Some people teach, some people run podcasts, some people write, some people, work in restaurants so that they can do their storytelling. And for me, I've engaged with this a lot. And I think there's like a couple of key things to think about is like, one, where is there some type of alignment between your story and a brand partner? So if you do work around veterans, are there nonprofits or other organizations that might want to support you with not just money, but possibly exposure, be a screening partner, mm-hmm. or maybe a donor to that nonprofit wants to also do a collaboration between you and them where you'll have a screening there and there's resources that can be shared. And I think it's really important to think for any of those types of collaborations, like what you can offer them as a storyteller. So can you have a panel at their office? Can you bring more attention to their cause? Oatly has a lot of sustainability initiatives about climate change. And so we've screened the series in that context. We just did one in New York with a large climate group that they support. And so trying to think about what you, not just like, hey, I need money for my film, but
how can you help the brand? Yeah. Pitching what you can do really to support what they're already doing or what they're passionate about.
Exactly. And that can be with your story that's really developed already. That can be with something very early that you just have an idea for. And it's not a, I'm not the only person to do this. If you, look at, for example, at Tribeca and Sundance festivals we talked about, they now have brand sections in them. There's an event called Tribeca X, which is all about brand storytelling. We work with a lot of technology companies to do stories, some of which are more, feel more like traditional marketing or commercials, and some which are like this, which are really independent stories that they support. And so, I wish we lived in a world, to be honest with you, where going back to all the stuff happening in the industry, where you have a great idea, the streamer buys it and you go to the festival and you get your big fee and you make your art. But I think, again, this is a very dynamic time. And you have to be resourceful and go different places. And that can be, trying to go to high net worth individuals and finding the subjects that they care about and partnering with you. If you're working on animal rights, there's people that are working on that. How can your story help advance them? So, we talked, filmmaking is very collaborative in all of the artistic senses, but it's also collaborative in the greater business, cultural, financial context. And I think it can also be additive to your distribution plan to have a nonprofit or a brand or a company or a small business behind you. And it can be great exposure for them as well.
Absolutely. Well, this has been super enlightening. Thank you so much for your time, for sharing your information. I know that it's hard won, and it's just such a gift that you are willing to share that with me and with the other filmmakers that are listening. So that's incredibly generous, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Yes, thank you.
I wondered if you would share one more thing, which is we always like to ask our filmmakers to bring something to everyone's favorite section, DocuView Deja Vu. So did you bring a documentary that you could share with our listeners that you might think they would enjoy?
I did. And today I'm going to recommend Secret Mall Apartment by Jeremy Workman.
Okay.
It is a documentary about a group of artists who build a secret apartment inside the Providence Mall in Rhode Island and live there for nearly a decade without the mall ever finding out.
No way.
Yeah. And the reason I recommend it is not because Jeremy is an amazing filmmaker. He was also the editor of our trailer for The Price of Milk, but also because it did not get traditional distribution. And instead, Jeremy ran an independent theatrical campaign around the country. And I think the film has grossed over $1 million after being turned down by every distributor. So I don't think it's in theaters anymore. You'll have to catch it on digital. But it's a great example, not only of a really awesome story about kind of artists and gentrification and radical self-expression, but it's also a great example of how you can get your movie out into the world despite the gatekeepers saying no.
Can he come on our podcast too?
Yeah, I can introduce you guys.
I would love to have him on. That would be amazing. Thank you so much for recommending.
Yeah, send me a note, check out the movie, and I'll send you guys an e-intro. He's a close collaborator and a really talented artist.
Fantastic. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate having you on.
Totally. And just thank you, Christian. I mean, the background of everything we talked about is there's just not enough exposure for these films and sure. for us as storytellers. So I'm just like always happy to talk to you about my projects because you're doing a really important service to the community.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody. Hey, everybody. This podcast is brought to you by Documentary First Productions, and we need your support so that we can keep preserving history. If you could go over and grab some merch or watch our films at documentaryfirst.com, you'll help us keep making awesome documentaries and sharing the stories that matter, and also bring amazing filmmakers and their wonderful films to the world. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you for visiting documentaryfirst.com.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.